Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
What I want to talk about tonight is climate change and the evidence and our options. But I want to take it from a tropical perspective of the world. But I also want to give a little bit of history behind that, because there are a lot of parallels to David Keeling, early's works and his trials, and the importance of persistence in science. This is actually one of the places we've drilled. It's Huascarán in the Cordillera Blanca down in Peru. It has a record that goes back 19,000 years of climate at 9 degrees south of the equator. I want to acknowledge that this is a team effort. We have a great team. Some of these people have been with us over 25 years. I want to present glaciers, the recorders of climate change, and as I say, a little bit of the history and the importance of data. I think David Keeling showed that dramatically with the measurement of CO2. You have to have data to make the case. Evidence for climatological uniformity and application at high elevations in the tropics. This makes the tropics a very unique place on our planet. Impacts of climate change on past civilizations. Can we learn any lessons by looking at civilizations and the climate in these areas? And one of the things about working in low latitudes, this is where civilization developed, and so we can often draw parallels to that. Evidence for recent acceleration in the rates of ice loss, and I'm only going to talk about three places, Quelccaya in the Andes of Peru, Nanunami in the southwestern Himalayas, Kilimanjaro in Africa, and our most recent drill site, Papua in Indonesia. Evidence for an abrupt climate change during periods of warmth, and I'm going to look at one event 5,000 years ago. If you think about the future, what we really need to know is whether are abrupt climate change events possible under a warm climate. We know they're possible under a cold climate, under an ice age climate. And a clear and present danger is the decapitation of tropical glaciers. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about our options and some conclusions. Well, we know the climate of the Earth is determined by many natural mechanisms, and has been so for hundreds of thousands of years. Changes in the sun, the 12-year Swabi cycle, the 90-year Gleisberg cycle, certainly, and energy coming to the planet oscillates with that. Changes in the amount of volcanic dust in the atmosphere. This is actually shows the eruption of Pinatubo in 1991. And then also internal variability in the climate system, like El Nino. We know that has tremendous impacts, and it's been in play at least for thousands of years. Then on top of that, we have the human factors. Changes in the greenhouse gases through time and the human impact on that, and Dave Keeling demonstrated that without a doubt. Changes in aerosols and particles from burning of fossil fuels, sulfate aerosols, black carbon, soot, biomass burning, all that impacts our system. And then there's changes in reflectivity as we clear forest for cropland and food production. We have a number of quite good models to look at how these various factors would change the temperature profile in our atmosphere. And if you're looking at well-mixed greenhouse gases, you can see that temperature response is mainly in the troposphere, in the lower atmosphere where we live. And we actually get a cooling up in the stratosphere. Whereas when we look at some of these natural variations, like in volcanic eruptions, you get warming in the stratosphere and cooling in the troposphere. And if you were looking at solar irradiance, then you would expect the stratosphere and the troposphere to warm uniformly because energy is coming from outside. And then we can look at how all these factors determine the temperatures on the planet. If we are looking at temperatures, recent temperature variations, from 1960 up to 2009 or so. These are in the mid to upper troposphere. You can see the warming trend, the lower troposphere, the surface of the planet. But when you get into the lower stratosphere, you can actually see the cooling that's taken place. And where there's volcanic eruptions, you can see that you get cooling in the lower atmosphere after these events, but you get a warming up in the stratosphere. And this is what our model says. This is what we should see. The Earth is warming, and we know that from our temperature records from around the planet. 2005, warmest year on record. 2010, at least in some of these records, equals that for the planet. We know that temperatures have risen about 0.75 degrees C in the last 100 years. And in today's world, we have a good view of where those temperature changes are taking place in the polar regions in the Arctic and down in the Antarctic Peninsula, but also the interior of continents around the world. Unfortunately, when we talk to people about climate, we generally respond to what's in our backyard. And over the last couple of winters, we've had unusually cool winters in North America and over in Europe and Siberia. And of course, you can look at the relative response of people to global warming and whether this is an issue, and it really is very much reflects what's going on in their backyard. But you can look at these same periods of time on a global scale, and you can see that the world was indeed very warm during those periods. But still, we respond to what's outside. This is probably the icon of human impact on the climate system, and it represents the efforts of a lifetime. And I think that these type of databases are extremely important for building the basis for understanding climate change. And certainly Dave Keeling was the pioneer in this. We can extend that history by looking at what's recorded in ice and looking at the bubbles in the ice. And this is a record of CO2 and methane in red from the EPICA cores. And if we look at where we are now with the levels of CO2, we're at 390 parts per million by volume, methane about 1,800 parts per billion of volume. And there's no analog to this in this 800,000-year history that we have in the ice. And, of course, our concern is where will be by 2100, not so far in the future, on the path, the trajectories that we're currently on. And the concern, of course, is has been focused on CO2 because it remains in the atmosphere for decades to millennia. So when we release it to the atmosphere, it takes a long time for it to be removed. And this kind of illustrates that. This is the K. Say if you had a large emissions of CO2, you would have, after 100 years, you still have 33% still in the atmosphere. After 1,000 years, you still have 20% or so. And after 100,000 years, you'd still have 15%. So you're talking about long-term changes in the system. And then the question of how that will impact our future temperatures on the planet. We have many records, paleo records, that tell us what's happened over the last 1,000 years. And I don't think it's a combination of these records that's important. It's the fact that so many different records give you a similar story. And then where we are today, and then where our best models predict we will be by 2100. And when you think about a 3-degree warming for the planet, and you, from a geologic perspective, you ask, when was the last time the Earth was 3 degrees warmer? You have to go back to the Pliocene about 3 million years ago. And if you asked a very important question, what was sea level at that time, it was 25 to 35 meters higher than today. And this is really the concern. So this has already occurred, and then where we end up on this curve is going to depend on what the future energy policies are for the world. If you look at CO2 emissions, these are coming from fossil fuel burning and cement manufacturing, so these are gigatons of carbon per year. And you look at all the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that have come out, and you look at this curve, and you can see that we've had very little effect on the emissions that are taking place. And I was at a General Electric Energy Conference a few months back, and you've all seen this picture that shows the planet at night from the space shuttle. And you can see the energy that's being consumed, and a large part of that's coming from fossil fuels. But they also showed what the world would look like by 2030. And so this is their view of what the world would look like. And if we continue on that line, the change will be so tremendous, and the glaciers I'm going to talk about are probably history for our planet. But I also like to, when I look at this, to point out that here, if we ever get serious about this, there's a lot we can do, because 80% of the energy that you see here is going to space for no purpose. So if we get serious, I think there's a lot that we can do to conserve the energy that that we're currently producing. So as I say, we're very fortunate to live on a planet that has many wonderful recorders of the past, and that's where we get the perspective of change. There's a few of them listed here, and I'm going to talk about the ice core histories. I want to use the ice as kind of an indication of that history. This is the margin of the Quillacaya ice cap down in the Andes of Peru. So this is 14 degrees south of the equator, about 19,000 feet above sea level. And each of those is an annual layer because there's a very strong wet and dry season. So you can see there's a history there. If you were to drill it, you can get that history, a very fine record of the past. So those are the annual layers. So to kind of tell this story, I'm going to use a fake ice core from showing time. So you have to look at an ice core. Generally, time starts at when you drill it from the surface. So 2011 would be at the top, and you would count your way back in time. So one of the lessons you learn is to experience failure early in your career. I think that's important, and you need to learn to turn that into a success somehow. When we first started about thinking about drilling in the tropics, there was a fellow, John Mercer, who was a geographer, but he had these photos of glaciers of the world. And looking through those, we found an aerial photo of an ice cap in the Andes, the Quillacaya ice cap. When we took those photographs to Washington to sit down with the program manager at the Institute of, or at the Polar Programs office, and after we finished, he said, well, Lonnie, you know, that sounds really interesting, but you know I can't fund it because it's not north of the Arctic Circle and it's not south of the Antarctic Circle, and we don't fund anything anywhere else. So I ended up in 1974 going to Antarctica on my first expedition to West Antarctica, and you can see why I started thinking about working in the tropics after 2 months of this. In February, I got a telex from the program manager, which read, I have funded all of my real science projects, and I have $7,000 left. What could you do on this tropical glacier for $7,000? And I said, I think we could get there. And so the next summer, we made our first trip to Quillacaya. But that was only the beginning of our woes. We were able to demonstrate there was a wonderful record here, but then we had to get that record. And so being naive and young, I thought we'd just bring a drill from Antarctica, a generator. We'd make a contract with the Peruvian Air Force. We'd bring a Bell 212 twin-engine helicopter, which we flew for 13 hours from the coast up. There were no airports up here in Sequani, so we brought the fuel in drums on a boxcar on a train, and we staged this out of the back of a hotel in Sequani. But when we get up to 19,000 feet, this helicopter would just fall. Even though we did it early in the morning, late in the evening, when there was not very much convective activity, but it was clear that there was no way this drill was going to get to this ice field. And since it was a two-day journey from the end of the nearest road to the ice field, we just couldn't drill it. And so that's when you start thinking, well, you know, maybe this is not doable. Or you think of another way that you might do it. So this is the first time we started thinking about, okay, a lightweight drill and solar power as a power source for running that drill. And so we But in order to do this, we had to write a proposal to NSF to get the money to build the drill. And one of the reviewers was Willie Dansgaard, who was one of the pioneers in our field. And he wrote a review, a very short one, and he sent me a copy. And it said that the Quelccaya ice cap, which you see in the background here, is too high for human beings, and the technology does not exist to drill it. And so he carried a lot of influence, but fortunately, there was a program manager who read it, and he said, well, you know, he may be right, but how will we know if we don't try? So we built a solar-powered drill, the first for drilling ice, and we tested it off of a parking garage in Columbus, Ohio, brought in blocks of ice, and seemed to work. But 2 weeks before I left on this, I took the MBA exam in the business school at Ohio State, because I figured, you know, fail twice, you probably wouldn't get funded again. So on these horses are solar panels in these red bags. And one of the lessons I think you learn here is that those who question your ability may do you greater service than those who offer faint praise. By meeting challenges head on, you will become sharper and more competitive. So in 1983, this is the crew. After 3 months, we drilled two cores to bedrock using this solar-powered drill. And this is what the first solar-powered drill looked like. But it did the job, and we didn't have the technology then to keep the ice frozen, so we brought back 6,000 bottled water samples, and one set of samples we sent to Willie Dansgaard's lab for analysis, and then from that time on, he was our greatest supporter of this type of research. So believe in yourself, be flexible, and seize any opportunity that creates other options. So from this site, we have now, over the last 30 years, drilled all the sites that you see here. So it's been a team effort, and the most recent site you can see here near Funcajaya in what we call New Guinea. In the polar regions, we have wonderful long records, one that I showed going back 800,000 years. In the tropics, we have records that are high resolution, and our oldest records in the deep tropics go back about 25,000 years. So you can look at the glacial conditions in tropical regions. The change that's taken place is, you can see here, this was when I was a graduate student, 1977, the same place in 2002, which demonstrates that there are two things going on here. One, we're losing the history in the ice, because when it melts, it's gone. And the other is that we're losing a very valuable water resource for people who live in these areas. Ice is a wonderful archive of many different variables in our atmosphere, and these are some of the ones that we measure. There are many more that are being measured in today's world, but anything that's in the atmosphere gets frozen and archived, and we can look at that. And often in the tropics, where there's wet and dry seasons, you can actually see the annual layers in the ice when you're drilling. So we have these histories from polar regions and from high mountain regions around the world, and they come from areas where we don't have good records of our past. Of course, you have to have labs, clean rooms to do the analysis in, mass specs for isotope measurements. We have now over 7,000 meters of core stored at minus 30 degrees C. It's the only tropical collection on Earth. And one of the things we're doing is keeping an ice for the future, because we know 20 years from now there'll be brighter people and better techniques, but in a lot of places, as I'm going to show, there will be no ice. We also design and build the drills that are used. They have to be lightweight and portable to get to 20,000 feet on a mountain range. I think that often we forget that we live on a planet that is a sphere. And because of that, we have 50% of the surface of the planet actually in the tropics. And we also have 70% of the people who live on this planet living in that part of the world. And sometime this year, our population on the planet will cross 7 billion people. And so it's an area that we need to understand better, natural and human-driven changes. The other thing that makes the tropics unusual is that while you have lots of temperature variations at sea surface, and precipitation, as you can see here, very much follows those changes, when you get up to the mid-troposphere where all the glaciers set, you have very uniform temperatures in the tropics. And I think that's why we get a very uniform response in the glaciers, and 100% of the glaciers in this zone are retreating in today's world. So I'm going to take you back to the Quellaveco ice cap in the southern Andes of Peru, because this turns out, we didn't know it at the time, but it's the largest tropical ice cap on the planet, and it has the highest resolution of any ice core that will ever be drilled out of the tropics. Didn't know that 30 years ago, but we know it having drilled in so many parts of the world. We've also perfected the techniques to keep the core frozen, bringing them out of these remote parts of the world. So we actually brought frozen core back. This is what an ice core looks like coming out of the drill on the summit of this ice field. These cores have this wonderful annual stratigraphy. These are dry season dust layers. You can see them in the crevasses. And if you go down in the crevasses, you can see that they're very horizontal. In the tropics, you have intense solar radiation, even in the wet season, that fuses the surface. So when the afternoon thunderstorms come, you don't get a lot of drifting that you see on many parts of the world. So these are a good record of net balance or precipitation when you measure those thicknesses through time. To give you an idea of how you date a core, this is the isotope records from Quellaveco. You can see the annual cycles. These are the annual dry seasons. So this is 1805 to 1825, and I'll just look at some segments going deeper in the core. 1520 to 1560, you see each of the annual layers. The Spanish arrived in this part of the world in 1531, so our first written records come after, records that we can read, interpret, come after that. And then you can go deeper, and you can see that from 1240 to 1330, and you can see how time's getting compressed in ice because it's a viscous fluid, and this characterizes all the cores that we drill. The reproducibility of the record is amazing. These are decadal isotopes from the 1983 Willie Dansgaard's lab on water samples, and then 20 years later, the ice core samples that came back from the summit and from the North Dome 2 kilometers away. So you can see the little ice age in this part of the world, and you can see the warming in the 20th century and how that has changed. You can do the same thing with precipitation, net balance. So you can see that from 1,000 up to about 1,500, it's dry. That's the brown areas. And the blues are periods where they're wetter than average. And if you look at the 20th century, you can see that it's been wetter than average during this period of time when the isotopes are enriching. The other thing that's very important in this part of the world, and here in Southern California, is El Nino variations. And this ENSO oscillation can be seen in precipitation. This is the brown areas are lower precipitation, and the greens are higher. This is during the 97-98 El Nino. And so you can look at South America. And if you look at Peru, what you see is the northern part of Peru is wet, above average. That's where you get floods in the deserts. And in the southern part of Peru, where Quellaveco is located, you actually get droughts. And when we have a La Nina event, southern part of Peru gets heavy rain, and the northern part of Peru is extremely dry. So there's this seesaw oscillation that takes place. And what we found when we look at the history in these ice cores is that we can look at that relative to the human records, the archaeologist history. And I don't know if any of you have been to Machu Picchu. It's a wonderful feature. And its water source came directly from precipitation. So they very much depended on water. But there's a long history of cultures in this part of the world, which makes it a fascinating place to work. And what we've found is when we look at the precipitation history, which is shown here, the blues are above average and the browns below average through, as in the other diagram. And then you look at the history of civilizations. And you can see when it's dry in the highlands, we have the coastal civilizations like the Mochi and the capitals on the coast. When it gets wet up in the highlands, we have development of the highland cultures like Tiwanaku down around Lake Titicaca and Awari cultures. When it becomes dry again, the civilizations move back to the coast, like with the Chimur. And then when it gets wet again, we have the rise of the Inca culture, which is the largest empire that's in that part of the world, which came to an abrupt end when the Spanish arrived in 1531. But it raises the question that if you were to look at today's world, the upper part of this record, the last 100 years have been wetter than average. History would say people should be moving from the coast to the highlands. But in fact, since the 1940s, there's been a huge migration of people out of the highlands to the coastal cities like Lima. And we now have over two-thirds of the population in Peru on the coast. We have government policies that are changing, turning the desert sand dunes into fields for growing things like asparagus. Last year, Peru became the number one asparagus producer on Earth, selling asparagus in New York City and over in Europe. And you wonder if this is sustainable when you look at the long-term trends, because here's a country with two-thirds of their population living in the desert, depending on rivers that source from glaciers up in the Andes, and they get 76% of their electricity from hydropower that comes from those same rivers. So these are huge huge changes that seem to go against the long-term changes that we see from the archaeological records. I don't know if any of you, the older folks here probably know of Thor Heyerdahl, but I was fortunate to go to a conference that he sponsored back in 1998 when he was 85 years old. And he, at the beginning of that conference, asked two questions. He wanted to know why it was 3,100 BC, about 5,000 years ago, civilizations developed in Sumerians, the Egyptians, and in this valley culture. And then he also wanted to know why it was important suddenly for us to keep track of time. The calendars were invented. The Mayan long count calendar, which a lot of you have heard of, started on August 12th, 3,112 BC. But there are a couple of Hindu calendars that start within 20 years of those same dates. And, you know, why was it suddenly important for people to keep track of time? And at the time, I remember thinking that we will never have records that would allow us to address that issue. In 2002, along the margins of Quelccaya, this is what this area looked like in 1977. This is now a lake in here. And this is the backside of that lake in 2002. And you see a person for scale, ice wall, and there's a plant deposit here. It's a wetland plant deposit, perfectly preserved, no woody tissue. And it was clear even to a glaciologist that if you could collect this, someone could probably identify it, and then we could carbon 14 date it, and we could tell the last time that this glacier was as small as it is today. And so here's the plant in 2002, it's amazing how fast these walls are retreating. You can see the ice wall right behind the man collecting the sample. And here's the same plant 3 years later, so you can see where the ice wall is. We've now collected over 60 plants and have carbon dated them. And the youngest dates on these plants are 5,000 years ago. We have older plants, but none that are younger. And so we have since started looking around at other things coming out of the ice that have similar dates. You've probably heard of Ötzi, the Iceman, came out of a glacier in the Alps in 1991. He's also about 5,200 years old. Same as the plants in the southern hemisphere in the Andes. And if any of you have been up to Lake Tahoe, in the southern part of Lake Tahoe, there is a forest underneath the water. You see some divers here. And these trees drowned about 5,000 years ago when water levels rose to the current outflow in the Truckee River. So the question is, you know, what happened 5,000 years ago that had these large-scale impacts? And you can see them in other records that we have that record the climate history of the Earth. In Kilimanjaro in Africa, the lowest isotope record in the entire history is 5,200 years ago. A speleothem record, there are several speleothems in southern Israel. You can see this event here. And if you look at the ice core records, the methane records from the polar regions, both Antarctica and Greenland, you can see methane was decreasing up to 5,200 years ago and then has been increasing ever since. And so one of our research objectives is to try and figure out what caused this event 5,000 years ago. If we come back to the present and we look at those two recent cores from the Quelccaya ice cap, these are 100-year averages of isotopes. This is the 20th century here. And you can see the isotopically they're the most enriched in the last 100 years. You can see that the last 100 years is wetter, but there were periods in the past when it was even wetter in that part of the world. But it's very clear that what's happening to the glaciers here is being driven by temperature rather than precipitation. We can see that in the isotope record as it's preserved in the glaciers. This is a core that was drilled in 1983 from the summit of Quelccaya. Depth, these are isotopes. And this is the 2003 core. And you can see when you get into the ice that everything is recorded and preserved in the ice. But in the upper fern, where it's porous and water can move through it, we've lost the signal. So in these glaciers, we're now starting to lose the memory system that they had in place for at least 1,700 years for this particular ice field. We can look at isotope records from cores throughout the tropics. These three cores and four cores out of Tibet. This is a composite for the last 2,000 years. And you can see the medieval warm period, little ice age. But what really stands out is an enrichment in the 20th century. And you can see a similar thing if you look at temperature reconstructions for the northern hemisphere, the instrumental record here on top, and what really stands out is the last 50 years of change. Now, I can tell you, you can show this to senators, and they kind of glaze over because they start wondering, okay, well, about isotopes. But the glaciers tell us change in many ways. But here's my favorite quote from Henry Pollack's book in 2009, A World Without Ice. You know, ice asks no questions, presents no arguments, reads no newspapers, listens to no debates, is not burdened by any ideology, and carries no political baggage. As it changes from a solid to a liquid, it just melts. And I can tell you what will work in the U.S. Senate is to show them some pictures of how the ice is changing. These are, and I'm going to show you a few of these, starting up in the Brooks Range in Alaska, 1958, same place in 2003. And when you look at these, glaciers are just water on land. When they melt, they go into the world's oceans and contribute to sea level rise. 100% of the glaciers in the Brooks Range are retreating in today's world. Southeast Alaska, this is the Muir Glacier, 1941, 800 meters thick, 2004. Southeast Alaska, 98% of the glaciers are retreating in today's world. If you go to the Himalayas, it's harder to find old pictures. This is a glacier in 2002, debris covered. But if you look where it was in 1957, you can see how much ice is melted out of this valley. If you go to the Alps, we have our oldest pictures there. This is 1903, and you can see the ice coming down these valleys. This is where the ice is in 2005. We've spent a lot of time working on Kilimanjaro in Africa, and this is the oldest picture we could find from 1912. These are glaciers. It's not snow cover. It's actually glaciers on the mountain. 1970, you can see a canyon starting to open up. 2000 when we drilled here, and then by 2006. And the changes are dramatic on these ice fields. This is a northern ice field. This is the drill dome. The northern ice field is 50 meters thick, and we drilled three cores to bedrock from there. And the lower 49 meters looks like this, and this would be kind of what you expect from normal ice. But the upper 65 centimeters, you see these elongated bubbles. These form when you have melting and refreezing taking place. And had this occurred in the past, you would see these in the ice itself, and they're not there. And the core dates back to 11,700 years in age. One of the things glaciologists do is put stakes on these glaciers, and we monitor those stakes. This is in 2000. This is in 2004, the same stake. And so in today's world, these glaciers are losing ice from the surface down. There's no net accumulation taking place. They're losing area. This is Furtwanger Glacier here in the crater. In 2000, you see this embayment. By 2006, and then by 2007, the glacier had split in two. And of course, as you expose more of the darker bedrock, you're absorbing more energy, and you get this feedback in the glacier system. One of the things we did on the Furtwanger was to put accumulation stake, and it goes all the way through when we take the core out to bedrock. So the lower part is drill extensions, and the top is bamboo, and you can see it here. And we've been monitoring that. So this is in 2004. By 2009, this bamboo section has fallen over, and you see the base of the drill extensions coming out. And so back in 2000, the glacier was about 9.5 meters thick, and the drill extensions were 4.67 meters, so that means that we had lost 4.83 meters from the surface down, or about 50% of the thickness over that 9-year period. And this averages out to about 0.54 meters per year. And as you go forward in time, this glacier will disappear sometime before 2018 at this current rate of ice loss. But if you're monitoring this from a satellite or from aerial photographs, in 2017, there will appear to be a glacier here, but it's going to be very thin, and the following year, it'll be gone. So you really need to have ground truths in this. This shows Furtwanger in 2009, and the loss of ice here, we've lost 86% of the ice that was on the mountain back in 1912 when the first map was made. And that loss continues. And here's the latest photo we have from the International Space Station. You can send coordinates up to places on the Earth and ask them to take a photo. And so this is on August 12, 2010. Furtwanger is now broken into three pieces. And sometime in the next few months, the northern ice field will divide in two. So the loss of ice continues in that part of Africa. Down in the Andes of South America, the longest monitored glacier is actually in the tropics, is actually the Quelccaya ice cap. And we've been monitoring this outlet glacier, which is the largest one, since 1978. So 1978, in 1991, a lake started forming in this valley. And by 2006, that lake covered 84 acres and is 60 meters deep. And if you look at the rate of ice retreat up the valley, shown in green here, in the first 15 years, it's about 6 meters per year. In the last 15 years, it's been over 60 meters per year, so 10 times faster. And you can look at this on using images, satellite images, and you can see that this is Corycalis. You can see the whole ice cap is retreating. And we've actually lost 25% of it since I started working there in the mid-70s. This is a boulder that was being pushed in 1977. In the next photo, you're going to see the end of this boulder looking out at the glacier in 2006. And you see the lake that's formed here. And if you were up on the ridge back in 1978, here's the boulder. You can see where the glacier is. And then this is the same place in 2006. Here's the boulder, and you can see how much ice has been lost over that period of time. We spent 30 years working in Tibet, and I think it's interesting also if you look at the research in this part of the world. When we went the first time in 1984, This is right after relations were normalized between China and the U.S. These are the sites that we've drilled with our Chinese colleagues from the Institute of the Tibetan Plateau Research. And the this core is the highest core drilled to date on Earth. It's from 7,200 meters at the top of the Himalayas. There's a lot of interest and growing interest in this part of the world because of the potential impact on water resources and how that might impact security issues in India, Pakistan, and China. If you look at the source of these major rivers, like the Indus River actually starts up in here, the Ganges River, the Brahmaputra River actually flows along the northern flanks of the Himalayas and starts right at the base of this place called Nananami, and that's the most recent place we've drilled. This is what the highest place drilled to date looks like. And if you want a record of monsoons, this is the place to go because the moisture is coming right out of India up over the Himalayas. So there's a wonderful annual record back to 1440, and the record goes back about 6,000 years. This is the Nanunami site, which is further to the west. Wonderful place. And if you make your way up through these valleys, up to the Nanunami Glacier, and then up along these lateral moraines up to the top, this is the top of the mountain. And in 2006, we drilled three cores to bedrock. This is the drill camp out there. The deepest is 156 meters in depth. This is why you need lightweight drilling equipment, because you have to carry it up there and assemble it. It's always exciting to drill in a place where no one has ever drilled. You're sure to find something new and exciting, and so when these cores come up, each one is exciting. But then we're faced with the issue of how you get them out of there and keep them frozen to get them back to Ohio State University. And I'm just give you an idea of how that's done. These are porters and Sherpas, and each one of these has a meter of ice in the core. And all the cores are stored under the surface of the ice until it's time to move them. But when you get down to the edge of the glacier, you're still about 4,000 feet from where the trucks can come in at the base, so you have to go to the local transport system. These are yaks. These are insulated boxes. Each of these have cryopack material that was frozen at the summit in the boxes to keep them frozen as they go down. And, of course, there's 6 meters of core in one of these boxes and 12 meters per yak, and we drill 500 to 600 meters of core. So you have to have a whole herd of yaks to take these cores down. You get to the trucks, you put them in the truck, and then you do a dash driving day and night to 2 days to get to Lhasa, where the first freezers are, where you can actually store the ice. And then we air cargo it out of there, Beijing, clear customs, Chicago, clear customs, and truck it to Ohio State. So they're usually in transit for about a month from the drill site. The first thing we do when we get them back is we look for the thermonuclear bomb test that humans have done in the atmosphere. This leaves a radioactive layer in glaciers around the world. These are all the previous sites that we've drilled. This is the 62-63 Soviet test. Find that, you know, you have a timeline and you know what the net balance accumulation has been since that test. On Nanunami, it was not there. So then we look for an earlier test. We look for the Ivy test, and here using chlorine 36 as the indicator. And these are the places like in China and on Kilimanjaro back in 2000, it was there. Waskaran, but on Nanunami, it's not there. And the reason it's not there is because these glaciers are losing mass from the surface down. And this is above 6,000 meters in the Himalayas at the source of all these major rivers. So we really need to understand better the scale of that. The last place I want to take you to is New Guinea. This is our latest place that we drilled. I can tell you we should have drilled back in 1936 when these glaciers were much better shape than they are today. This is 1991. You can see they're breaking up. And by 2001, in 2009, we did a reconnaissance, and there were a couple domes here that looked pretty good in 2009. But by 2010, this is what these glaciers looked like. There was wasting taking place across all the, even the very highest elevations on the ice fields. And this is the first glacier that we've ever drilled where I felt that we were too late to get a record. This is where my tent sat for 2 weeks. The reason it rained every day, and the tent protected the ice below it, but we lost about 30 centimeters vertically, which if you average, if that was any indication of what happens in a year, we're losing 7 meters of ice from the surface down. And since these glaciers are only 32 meters thick, you can calculate how soon that they would disappear. We were surprised to find that this is up at the drill site. So you see the crevasses, and that we were actually drilling under this tent here. And we drilled two cores to bedrock here and one over here. And we were surprised to see, this is the isotope history of these two cores. And you can see the reproducibility. And there's a signal, 5 to 6 parts per mil. Once you're in the ice, it seems the history is preserved there. So our challenge now is to put this into time. The loss of ice here is almost identical to what we see on Kilimanjaro, the first aerial photos back in the 1940s. The black dots are the Papua Indonesia, and you can see the projections for when those glaciers will disappear. So one of the questions is, why are these glaciers responding so rapidly at the high elevations? And in the beginning of this talk, when I talked about this 3-degree warming projected by 2100, that warming, this is going from 60 north to about 60 south, and that warming is projected to be 3 degrees at surface. But if you look at the higher elevations, particularly in the tropics, it's expected to be almost double that. And we believe that's why when we look at these glaciers, not only are they retreating in all these places that we've examined them, the rate of ice loss is accelerating as you come forward in time. So it's a very uniform picture coming from the tropics. I want to say a few words about impacts on people. I talked about Quelccaya. This was a glacier when I started working there in the 70s. It's now a lake. But for years, this camp was chosen because of the steady water supply down this valley. In 2006, this was the lake that had formed. By 2007, this lake was gone. It had drained. And if you go around this bend, this is the bottom of the lake, and the water is actually flowing into another valley now to the south. And so when you look at this valley, there's no water here. The vegetation has died. And the locals depend on these alpaca moths. This is usually filled with water right up to here. These are bright green to graze their alpaca. And they no longer come into this valley because there's no alpaca moths. And these are changes since 2007. This is the Corycalis Glacier, this lake, which started forming in 1991. This is July of 2005. In March of 2006, there was an avalanche that came off of here, fell into the lake, created a mini tsunami, and flooded the valley down below. Usually there are alpaca grazing on this meadow, but they were drowned when this event occurred. And the thing is that this would not have occurred before 1991 because there was no lake in this valley. There was a glacier, and so the ice would have just fallen onto a glacier. And at high mountain ranges around the world, we see these things develop. And if you, you've all heard about Antarctica and the changes there, particularly in the peninsula, and the breakup of these ice shelves. The interesting thing about that is that John Mercer at the Ohio State, what was then the Institute of Polar Studies, wrote a paper in Nature, 1978, saying that the first evidence of greenhouse warming due to increased CO2 would be the breakup of these shelves. And they would start in the north, and they would move to the south. He's long since passed away, but it's amazing how that's played out. And of course, these are floating, so when they break out, they don't change sea level. But what has been found here by Ted Skambos and others who study these glaciers is that the glaciers on land are now flowing 3 to 8 times faster because you don't have the buttressing effect of these ice shelves. And if you go further south, where there's still ice shelves, you don't see that acceleration. And those type of changes can cause sea level to rise much faster. The loss of Arctic sea ice has been consistent and very substantial since we've had satellite images. And, of course, the increase in the number of melt ponds on the surface of southern Greenland and water finding its way through moulins, lubricating the bottom of these glaciers. And now they're flowing much faster than glaciologists would have thought 10 years ago because we didn't think about this process. If you look in the big picture, the sea level rise in the 20th century, about 50% is thermal expansion. About 30% comes from these alpine smaller glaciers and 10 to 20% from the big ice sheets. And then we're pumping more groundwater than that's going into these systems. But the big increase in sea level from glaciers has been actually coming from the smaller mountain glaciers up to now. Since 1990, sea level is rising faster, about 3.3 millimeters per year. And many of the glaciers in Greenland and West Antarctica have accelerated discharge in the ocean 20 to 100%. And these are huge changes, but we don't have a long observational period. And so one of the big questions is what happens, how will they behave as we go into the future? So I want to come back to David Keeling and an event that was one of, the, I'm sure in both of our careers, one of our outstanding, was getting the Tyler Prize here in California and having that time to spend together. But if you look at what's happened to CO2 since that event, this shows the progressive increase, and this is really a concern when you look into our future. So you say, well, what are our options when you look in the future? And I really think there are only three options that we have. One, we could talk about prevention, which means taking measures to reduce the pace, magnitude of these changes in the global climate that are caused by the human activities. And these would be things like reducing these emissions of greenhouse gases. We can talk about enhancing the sinks for these gases. You can talk about geoengineering to counteract the effects of these gases. I mean, that's one of our options. Adaptation, which means taking measures to reduce the adverse impacts on human well-being that result from the climate changes that do occur. And examples would include changing agricultural practices, strengthening defense against climate-related disease, building more dams and dikes. But this is a moving target, and we're not very good predicting what's going to happen in regions around the planet. And the final one is suffering, and that's the adverse impacts that are not avoided by either mitigation or adaptation. And history of human beings would say those who suffer are those who are least able to adapt and have the least resources to do that adaptation, like this Quechua Indian girl that lives just below the Quelccaya ice cap down in the Andes in Peru. So climatologically, on this map, if you all these red areas are places where ice loss has been documented on the planet. And when we first started working on this, we had some blue areas where there were actually advancing glaciers. So climatologically, we are in unfamiliar territory, and the world's ice cover is responding dramatically to these changes. And it's interesting to ask some simple questions. What would happen if we lost 8% of the ice on Earth? We've lost 25% of Quelccaya, the largest tropical ice cap on Earth, since I was a graduate student. But what if we lost 8%? What would that do? Here's the coastal areas of southern U.S., Florida, New Orleans. If you lost 8%, this is what it would look like. So here we are. If you were to look at a place like New York City, this New York City lose 8% of the ice on the planet, it would look like this. And if you were to go to New Guinea, and you lost 2% of the ice on land, all this red area that you see here would be underwater. So you don't have to lose very much of the ice that's currently on our land surfaces to make a huge impact on human beings. So here are some of the key points in this presentation. Tropical glaciers integrate and respond to key climatological variables, such as temperature, precipitation, cloudiness, humidity and radiation, they kind of just sum that all up and respond to it. The observed rapid retreat of the Quelccaya ice cap can be attributed mainly to rising temperatures because the net balance, the precipitation, has been above average for the last 100 years for that area. The recently documented mass loss that we're seeing on Kilimanjaro in Africa, on Nanu Nami in the Himalayas, in the ice fields near Putrajaya in Indonesia, are disturbing because our best projections of temperature changes in the 21st century predict these high elevation, low latitude temperature increases. Under the current conditions, these and likely other tropical glaciers are being decapitated, that is, they're no longer accumulating at their highest elevations. The uniform distribution of temperature that these high elevations throughout the tropics and virtually the fact that all these glaciers are retreating point to rising temperatures as the major driver in the response that we're seeing with them. And finally, the loss of these tropical glaciers near populated areas is already impacting hydroelectric power production, irrigation, and municipal water supplies, and is storing a unique archive that we have from the ice fields that have preserved that history for centuries. And I think we're very fortunate to live on this planet that supports life and has so many spectacular places. But it's very clear when we talk about global climate change that nature's a timekeeper on these changes, and unfortunately none of us can see the clock that we're working with. And I would like to close with this quote. This is my favorite quote right now. There are three stages of any scientific discovery. First, people will not deny that it's true. Then they will deny that it's important. And then they will credit the wrong person for it. What makes this so interesting, and it was actually said by Alexander von Humboldt 150 years ago, so which suggests that we have not really progressed so far. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.